Welcome to Unlocking Secrets for Women. This is your host, Candace Newton. How many of you are afraid to fly? I know I was, and it's nothing to be embarrassed about. It's quite common, actually. I have the privilege of interviewing Captain Ron Nielsen, an airline pilot for U.S. Air over 20 years who've developed a program called Fearless Flight. Let's join Captain Ron as we listen to him talk about fear of flying. Welcome, and I'm really excited to talk to you. We've already chit-chatted a little bit before the interview started about really understanding the dynamics of the fear of flying, and of course on my website I've got a little place where you are now positioned under expert resources, and people can find your site from there, and they can learn about what you offer to help people in the fear of flying. But just talking about the dynamics of the fear of flying, can you just right off the top of your head, just tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got started in wanting to help people with the fear of flying?
You bet. Like so many good things in life, to me, it happened by default, Candace. I had been a pilot for 10 years, and actually 20 years. I had been in the airlines for 10 of that, and I moved from one airline to another airline, America West at the time, which has now evolved into U.S. Airways. And a mutual friend had told me that there was a psychologist that was looking to start a program for fearful flyers, and he needed a pilot to volunteer to help him. So I did that, and ultimately I ended up taking over the program. The psychologist and I are still good friends today, but his practice became so busy that he no longer had time to devote full time. So I did that, and it just grew. And I was, first of all, I was totally surprised at how many people fly on a regular basis who are terrified of it. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that the ones that I've run into who absolutely will not fly. I was doing a book signing one day in the Tennessee area, and a librarian came up to me, and I said, "Now, you don't look like somebody who's afraid to fly." And she said, "Oh, no." She said, "I won't even get on one." And that also points to another thing. There are so many people who don't describe themselves as afraid of flying, but they say, "Well, I'm not a good flyer." I had a lady who was writing an article, and she was interviewing me, and she said, "Well, I'm not afraid to fly, just I'm not a good flyer. I get nauseous, my stomach goes into knots, and I notice that my knuckles are white when I'm flying." And you may want to reframe that into fear of flying. But a lot of people don't see that as an element of fear. Now it's been 20 years ago since I did that, and the latest statistics from the Gallup organization in just the U.S. say that there are 18% of the population describe themselves as very afraid to fly, and another 26% describe themselves as somewhat afraid. So those are the people who admit it, and my own personal experience on any one of my flights, I figure that I have at least 25% to up around 50% of the people on there have some issues with being afraid to fly on an airplane.
Oh my goodness. And I certainly have been one of them.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty normal. And we were talking a little bit earlier before we started the interview about some of the dynamics that can cause those fears of flying. And so basically from your experience and the years that you've been sort of coaching people and helping them work through these fears, if that's the right term, I'm coaching.
It's a perfect term.
Oh, good. Is it that you have found? How much percentage of that flying, the fear of flying, is truly the fear of flying itself, where it's completely associated with the aircraft and the lack of knowledge of how it works, as opposed to some other underlying factor that manifests in a fear of flying?
You know, I'm gonna reframe that.
Okay.
I'm gonna talk about surface fears and below the surface fears.
Okay.
Certainly, 100% of the fears are the surface fears are related to flying. You know, it may be. I noticed an article in the paper about airplane crashes or something like that. Or I'm on an airplane in turbulence and I worry about the airplane, the pilot's losing control, or things. Which then you go a level below that, it's about crashing, and
yes,
a level below that, it's about dying.
Right.
So ultimately, it's all the same fear, and that is an underlying fear that somehow we are not in control, and that is going to lead to our demise. Flying is an interesting, or aviophobia or fear of flying is an interesting fear, because I find that many other issues and fears get displaced onto flying, personally, my experience is because of the mystique that surrounds flying. So basically, you know, it's that fear of the boogeyman. If I don't know what's going on, and then anything uncertain or new and unfamiliar to me is going to probably trigger my fear about it. So on the one hand, I talk with people about the surface fears and deal with that, you know, like the sights, sounds, and sensations, which are plentiful and unfamiliar to people riding on airplanes. And then on the other one is underlying fears like control, and what can you do about that to get over it.
So when I'm thinking of sights, sounds, and sensations, I'm thinking that it depends on your perspective, I think. If you're thinking that you're going to an amusement park and that you want to get on this roller coaster that you've never been on before, and it looks like it could be fun, you start off, I think, with a little bit more positive approach to these new sensations that you may find pleasurable. But if you've already got something in your mind that is negative towards what you think you're going to have as an experience, then those sensations are intensified and they're extremely negative. Because I can even think for myself, I mean, one of the things that I did not understand until after I took your course was that the big thing for me, and it was another woman actually in one of your teleconferences that had brought it up as I was listening in on it, and she was talking about after the takeoff you need so much power and thrust to get you off the ground, and then when you get up to a certain place, of course you don't need that same power and you're still gaining height, but it feels like the airplane has shut off or stopped.
Because the decrease in the engine noise, of course,
Right, and that was terrifying for me because we're in this position and I'm just, and it was such a sensation that it actually caused for me that prickly cold feeling to go right up your leg like that. Terrifying rush of adrenaline, that fight or flight response, and then there's nowhere to go. You're locked in this seat, and your body's screaming at you, run, and there's nowhere to run, and you just feel like it's a terrible feeling. And until I understood what that process was, I couldn't work through it. And so having the knowledge that you have about airplanes and aircraft and what's going on allows a reasonable person, even if they're terrified, to begin to make a choice to reason that through. Is this really something that's, you know, my fear, or is this something that's actual factual going on that's quite safe? And I find that that was quite helpful for me. Now, everybody else has a different trigger point on what can cause their fears for them, and not everybody recognizes, as what we talked about a little bit, about the brain and how it holds on to information tightly until it's challenged and replaced with correct information and then made a willful choice to stay in that sort of piece of truth. But it's interesting, when someone does know the truth about the aircraft and they still are afraid to fly, what do you think is going on there?
Well, going back to where you started that part of your conversation, you're absolutely right. When a person goes to an amusement park to ride a roller coaster, they already have what I would call a positive bias in favor of their experience that they're about to encounter. But when you talk about the negative bias, which is the term that I use to describe a fearful flyer, for example, if I believe that flying is inherently dangerous, then when I am looking in my everyday experiences, for example, I pick up a newspaper and I happen to notice articles in there related to aviation. There could be 50 articles related to how safe it is, and one that talks about a really benign event where a mechanic was towing an airplane to the gate and hit a piece of equipment on the ground. And I, as a fearful flyer with a negative bias, I will latch on to that one negative article. And I'll completely discount the 50 positive articles.
Right.
And so when you add in the media and the likelihood that negative events in the news are going to be far more likely to be reported than positive events, particularly when it comes to aviation safety, then you see that, you know, that we're inundated with that kind of information. And so bias plays a real role on that. And again, as you said, the sights, sounds, and sensations, once a person you know, understand, a big part of the process can be helpful to understand what is the basis for those unfamiliar sights, sounds, and sensations. And some people do report immediate relief over that. And yet it is such a deep experience, and it is based in brain chemistry, that logic oftentimes does not override that. We get caught up in those obsessive thought loops, I call them, once your fear gets triggered, you know, in other words, you're sitting there in the airplane, you encounter a little bit of unexpected turbulence, which is very frightening because it you know, it has a sudden onset. You weren't able to anticipate it because you had no idea that it was going to and you were going to encounter it. And then all of a sudden, once that starts, it triggers that automatic process in the brain that starts pumping adrenaline and cortisol. So we start a thought process that sounds something like this. There's a thought that says, this can't be good. How am I doing? And the response automatically comes back from your brain, not very well. And that very not very well then reinvigorates that, how am I doing? You know, and we get into what I call this obsessive thought loop spiral that just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And then some people, in fact, do end up in a panic attack.
Right. Well, and they would, because it's just the track they're on, and there's just no getting off until something interrupts that process.
Yeah. Now the good news is that you can do an intervention on yourself, and so there's two things I talk about. One is, if you're the fearful flyer, breathing is absolutely the most powerful thing you can do, and I have one really crude strategy that has people have reported, to my surprise, with great success, and that is, instead of just normally breathing and trying to calm yourself and breathe, I have them grab a drinking straw from one of the fast food vendors at the airport, if you haven't had a chance to grab one before then, and put that drinking straw in your mouth and only breathe through the straw. The act of breathing through the straw artificially restricts the amount of air that you can intake and exhale in any one breath, and it will naturally slow your rate and your depth of breathing down.
Interesting, and it also causes great concentration, so it's a distraction to the brain.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And every strategy that I give people is twofold, just like you said, Candace. One is the mechanics of what you're trying to do, like slow your breathing, and the other is the thought process that now is diverted from that obsessive thought loop into whatever it was. So in the Fearless Flight Kit that I have developed, I have a book in there that talk about success stories of 8 fearful flyers, including myself, believe it or not, early in my life. And then I have a little flight guide that does talk about, it has a chronological listing of the sights, sounds, and sensations that you would encounter in a typical flight, so that you can distract yourself as well as learn about them. And then the third part is an audio CD that will actually guide you through a process of distracting your thoughts. And so in concert with that, you know, going back to the breathing through the straw, people have reported that, you know, they've actually been able to regain control of their cognitive process, their what their thoughts are, and as well keep them from moving, you know, up higher on the plane of anxiety, if you will, you know, to keep it more manageable.
And I have actually, I used that audio CD that you had created, and I put it into my MP3 player, and believe me, I had it tightly wrapped around my neck when I got onto the aircraft for the first time after taking your course. And it was probably one of the best things you said is, you know, I know that the pilots and the staff on board don't really like electronic equipment started before the plane, but it's an MP3 player and it shouldn't be a problem. And believe me, I had that on, and I was able to go through that. I listened to that audio several times as I was actually preparing for takeoff, sitting in the craft and you know, going through that process. And for me, I also had another focus. I was going to see my granddaughter who has cancer. I was going to go see her for the first time. So for me, that was a huge focus, to just focus on her and the fact that they needed me on that other end. And that sort of helped a lot. Now, I wanted to ask you an interesting question, and I really do highly recommend your book and your CDs and the Fearless Flight teleconferences, because I think that taking the biggest step of acknowledging that you've got a fear, you don't even have to get on a plane in order to deal with it if you're really truly terrified to fly. Right. Then you at least start with that, because you can, it's like looking as an observer without ever having to have the experience. You can be all around that experience without actually entering into it, and then starting to find your grounding and feel a little bit safe. So not even for people that are even intending to fly at the moment, but just know that they've been avoiding dealing with this issue, and maybe to begin to just investigate the possibility that this may be something they'd like to do one day, and right. will fly, and that by investigating their fear when it's in a controlled environment, it seems to me much more logical to try out. So I really, really recommend your book and the CD. I think you guys have done a great job, yourselves done a great, great job of being able to really tap into some tools that are very helpful.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you a question as we were talking. I'm an adult educator, and one of the things that I teach my students is that we can look at what's wrong until the cows come home. It's like looking at counterfeit money. Yeah. It's going to forever constantly change. And what I'm curious about is I tell them, you know, the best counterfeit detectors in the world are those that study the real and yeah. not the counterfeit. Like if in the case of money, they study the real money and they know it so well that when the counterfeit money shows up, they can instantly spot that it's counterfeit. They may not know exactly what's wrong at the moment, but they know, their brain tells them, this is not authentic. And what I wanted to ask you is, have there been research into studying people that don't have a fear of flying, and why that is?
Well, you know, there isn't really that much research about people who are afraid to fly, because, number one, because it's there's so much denial involved in it.
Yes.
You know, and institutional, you know, the airlines, you know, bless their hearts, they don't like to discuss that. As a matter of fact, I talked to one airline executive once, and he said, I talked about actually offering my audio CD as one of the entertainment channels. And he said, oh, no, we would never want to introduce the notion of people that are afraid to fly. And I
yeah.
said, well, you're not, it's not about frightening anyone. It's about the fact that you already have them on board. But there isn't a lot of research about that. There are some other areas of the brain that are, you know, coming because of the modern technologies, you know, MRIs and CAT scans and things like that,
uh-huh.
that they're looking at fear and the fear process and trauma. And you and I were talking about trauma beforehand,
uh-huh.
but a lot of what I believe is directly to fear of flying is related to trauma. And I talked about a definition as I've discussed with fearful flyers over the years, what they've described for me is a sense of impending doom. That's, you know, and for some it can start with just contemplating calling the reservations agent. And now, you know, all of a sudden this process starts and I think that I'm in danger. And it's accompanied with a feeling of helplessness. When you look at the classic definition of trauma, it's exactly the same.
Interesting.
A perception of being in a life-threatening situation combined with a sense of helplessness. So what seems to be the case is, you know, distraction, no matter how it occurs, and cognitive restructuring, you know, to use your words, to kind of focus more on what's right, you know, or what the truth is part of the process. And the next area that I touched on, you know, again, when we first started talking, was I'm looking big time into neurofeedback, because that seems to be a process that can actually induce the same benefits as talk therapy, cognitive therapy, specifically, without the talk.
Interesting.
And I've been through that, yeah.
Well, I know a little bit about biofeedback. I don't know a lot, but I do know that one of the skills that I learned in panic attacks was to be able to slow my own heart rate down.
Exactly.
Through
exactly.
concentrating and focusing yeah. on relaxing and breathing, just like what yes. you had talked about, breathing through a straw.
Yes.
It's a focused process. How does biofeedback differ from now this neurofeedback? What would be the differences if you were to see someone going through that process? What would you see?
It's mainly the equipment. In biofeedback, you get, you know, probably you had an auditory tone or maybe a visual stimulus that when your breathing rate and your heart rate, when they started to conform to your goal, you got some sort of feedback that let your body know that you were on the right track.
Uh-huh.
The equipment that's out now, and it's getting better and better every day with the greater capabilities and what we're learning from research, is you can sit there hooked up with very simplistic leads, modified form of electroencephalography, and computer software, and you can do the same thing. You will get a visual display in most cases, and an oral tone, audio tone, that tells you in the system that I use, there was a bar, and you were supposed to focus your intent upon lowering the bar.
Oh.
And in doing that, it was the darndest thing. I'm sitting there, and of course, the first thing that Mr. Controller wants to do is, you intently focus, say, okay, bar lower, boom, and it would go up out of sight. and then finally, the best way I can describe it, Candace, is after a while, I noticed, I'd say, okay, heck with it then. Obviously, I can't do it. Boom, the bar would lower.
Now, interesting.
It happens at a level below consciousness. So, which is where a lot of fear, phobias reside. So now, all of a sudden, I realize, and my brain makes a mental note of it. No pun intended. It says, okay, I get it. And within one session, I was able to lower the bar. And as I did, I ended up doing about a dozen sessions, and I could significantly lower the bar. Now, the key is there are different parts of the brain, and I recommend that I mention a book to you, A Symphony in the Brain, that talks in a general way about this. So there's the cerebral cortex has alpha waves, and so some of us, like me, and you, I imagine as well, we have overactive intellectual parts of us,
Yes.
That part of our brain is racing a lot.
Very stimulated, always on alert. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So the general requirement for us would be to lower our alpha waves. And so with the modern displays and computers, just laptops for that matter, we can now hook people up, and you can you can look at what your alpha output is doing, and you can work on neural visually feeding back to your brain and cause that to lower. Now, for other problems, depression and things like that, people need to raise certain parts of their brain, but there's alpha, theta, and a number of major brain waves that the brain produces. And with neurofeedback, not unlike biofeedback, you get a visual display that is easily interpreted in terms of a useful interpretation, and you can train your brain.
Now, is any of that new neural feedback available, those programs? Are they
it
still?
Is. Yeah, there are a variety of producers, and I'm looking into, I'm in the due diligence looking for a number of the people who have been in it for a long time. I apologize. I will get that information on the website.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Because I think that would be really practical.
Yeah.
And as a true control freak, which I think I'm admitting this for the first time publicly, but never would have believed that. Although my children have told me that I look, that I behave a lot like Monica from Friends.
Yeah, people who love us the most will give us the best feedback.
Yeah, they're like, Mom, you're kind of like, it doesn't, the couch doesn't have to be exactly in that position for it to be okay in the world. But I guess it's a bit of a revelation as I'm talking here. But
pilots are pilots largely because they are control freaks.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, huge controllers.
Well, you know what? It would make sense.
Yeah.
because they're taking the biggest thing they can master and managing it.
Exactly, and that's another thing. I work with the personality, and what we, it makes sense. The things that make us very, very skilled... I imagine a large part of your success is because you are good at controlling and managing. But there's always a downside to those things.
Oh yes, there is.
For pilots, you want somebody who values being in control and analyzing and taking definitive action, and at the same time, you want if you're going to be married to this character, you want him to be able to let go and attach emotionally sometimes. So
yeah.
So that's what I work with pilots. Much of my work in aviation the last 20 years has been not so much in the flying of airplanes as it is also in working with pilots, teaching them about their own personal dynamics and how to be more effective, in terms of coaching, performance coaching.
Wow. And we've sort of exchanged ideas on that already, and that is that would be a whole nother topic that we should approach, because I believe that you and I share some very similar perspectives and understandings on really how leadership handles their power.
Yeah. And not surprisingly, people who have a high need for control really become good candidates for fearful flying.
Ah, yes, I would imagine.
You simply are not. You can't, you know, there's only two people that get to fly the airplane. Everybody else has to ride in the back. And not surprisingly, some of the worst passengers are crew members, including pilots, who are extremely
critical of that person's ability to fly.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, wow, I could have done that better, and that takeoff wasn't so great, and that landing was terrible, and who is this person? And well, because of the level of knowledge. But I was making a note as you were discussing neurofeedback and biofeedback, and that I had this sort of joyful revelation that actually it gives you back control.
It does.
For someone who is a control freak, it gives you back control. You actually can learn to control your own body, which is the ultimate pleasure for a control freak.
Absolutely. And what I'm finding, in a way, is cognitive therapy does that same process. It's just slower and a little bit less targeted, if you will, less
right.
focused. So in talking to someone, explaining to them why right after takeoff, when we reduce the power ever so slightly on the airplane and they notice that diminishing sound, why that is no concern for worry. And in doing so, you really are allowing them a mechanism by which they can control their thoughts somewhat.
They can start to wrestle with now that they're faced with a new set of facts.
Exactly. So, number one, as we said, it takes up new RAM in their brain, if you will, because that in itself becomes somewhat of a distraction. And then, two, there's a process that they engage in to say, okay, I've heard this before. So now, in that moment, then, they capture a little bit more control or perceived control over their experience.
Hmm. And so if I, you know, because I really would like to just focus for the next couple of minutes on some really great things that people who are truly afraid to fly can begin to do. And of course, I think number one is to get onto the fearless-flight.com website, or you can go to my website at unlockingsecrets.com and look under resources and then expert information to see the link to your site and my own sort of little mini story. But that to me is first and foremost is, okay, there is some information available. Let's get to it. When you're doing your teleconferences, which are fantastic, by the way, because people get to speak to you live, and they get to speak with a couple of other people who are also sharing the same kind of experience at the same time, maybe a different manifestation, but basically the same route, we're all afraid to fly. What is the first thing that, if someone's listening right now, and they're saying, gosh, I've been afraid to fly, but I've never really wanted to admit it or think about it, what would be the first thing that you would suggest to them would be a great way to start to deal with what's going on with them inside?
The first thing I would commend them for would be their courage to face it and to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a problem unacknowledged can never be overcome. Because if I don't acknowledge that something is there's something about me that I want to change, then change is never possible. So that's the first thing. The second thing, believe it or not, I give them permission to give themselves permission to be afraid. Because a secondary part of an underlying part of being afraid to fly is, number one, it's whatever my surface fears are, crashing, dying, airplanes losing control, things like that. The second part is a sense of shame and embarrassment that I am afraid, because we constantly compare ourselves to others around us. And most often when it comes to things like underlying fears, like fear of flying, we misjudge and misperceive. So I'm sitting on the airplane feeling miserable, thinking that I'm all alone, when the truth of the matter is, as I've said already, you've got at least a third of the airplane in the back there that's already that's probably just as afraid as you are.
Right.
But nobody talks about it. So I teach people how to connect with themselves, first of all. What, you know, what are your fears? What goes on? What do you think? What's the story that you're telling yourself? You know, like, oh, wow, on takeoff, the power, the noise decreases. We must be going down because the engines have quit. So focus on that. And then the second thing is, Okay, what differs me from, what makes me different from people who are not afraid is my ability to disassociate from those obsessive thought loops. So I do that by learning how to distract myself. And distraction is a two-part process: educating myself, what's really going on in the airplane, and two, some other things like listening to the flight harmonizer in the Fearless Flight Kit, or listening to some audio books, or talking to a friend, or having a loved one next to me that can time my breathing and actually help me slow down, breathing through a straw, things like that. Those are that's the process. So the first thing is thanks, give thanks to yourself for acknowledging that you are afraid.
And I think that's a very good key point. And the other thing I find is that when, I know that I've done this in other situations, particularly in grief, that's, I work really strongly with people that are either experiencing a grief process or about to experience grief, and or the aftermath. It seems to be, I guess, just a sensitivity that I have. And one of the things that I generally start to tell them is that, you comfort them, but when you see that someone's locked into something that's tormenting them, which is what I did with myself, I basically say, you're allowed to feel that if you'd like to. In fact, you can keep that for the rest of your life if you like, but you owe yourself at least one shot to find out if what you're really believing is true. And then if it is, then okay, then no one's going to argue with you. But at least give yourself a chance to be willing to look at it and say, is it really, really true? Is my fear is real, there's no question, but is it the truth? And to allow yourself that, because I find if you even allow the tiniest window of light into something that seems to be locked in, you allow even the tiniest flicker of something that is even remotely different, you owe it to yourself to fan that enough to take a look at it. And I've had so many people in front of me, and I'm sure you've done the same, but maybe you do it differently with flying. I do it in different ways. I have someone in front of me that is truly, absolutely tormented over something, and to be able to look at them and say, I allow you to stay exactly where you are. Would you allow me to show you, not trying to change you, but just to show you that there's another piece of information here that you can either accept it or reject it, but let me at least share it with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's so powerful.
Yes. Yes.
Because then go ahead. What does that do when you hear that? What is that?
Well, what I call that, that's part of what I call the education process is to acknowledge the past and be grateful that that's how it got you to that point. That's what me is about, is whatever got us to this point, we need to thank, and then we make the decision whether it serves us anymore, and being open to new possibilities, because once that happens, then we can move on to new possibilities in our lives.
Yeah. And I think it's the introduction, and I think that's what this is about, and why I wanted to have your website and your program up on my website, and to let people know, men and women too, to let them know that, it's, you're not alone. There's millions of people that feel the way that you do, but give you hope is that at least you can look at it. If you still want to hang on to it, you can.
For sure. One of the most fulfilling things that's happened for me in doing this work is I find that there is a lot of grief involved. The unresolved grief oftentimes underlying a lot of people's fears. But a really interesting phenomenon is people who follow up and give me feedback say not only have they overcome their fear of flying, but now they notice that it was almost a metaphor for blocks in their life. So now people say, I'm now getting new promotions at work, I'm going for the gold, if you will, and it's opened up whole new possibilities in other areas of their lives.
Yeah, I believe that, because I think if you master a fear in one area, it's like it's like jumping over hurdles. You just think, well, the second one, this was the biggest thing that terrified me. And, you know, what other fears can I conquer right now? If I can gain some success by using tools and techniques to deal with this, what else is there in front of me that I can face? And I would so see how that would happen. Now, we're going to wrap this up because I want to be able to entice people to get off to your website. But I wanted to just say, now you've got a fantastic book, which is Chicken Soup for the Soul, and it's a Fearless Flight Kit. And that is, of course, everybody's familiar with the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. They know that it's a book that has brought warmth and care, and that's sort of associated with that whole Chicken Soup for the Soul, that healing, you know, the chicken soup being the great thing that your mom brings you when you're sick.
Right.
Healing. And where are your books purchasable? Like, where can they buy the Chicken Soup for the Soul Fearless Flight Kit?
Well, of course, they're available on the website without question, and also they are available in all the major bookstores, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and all the
major
borders, major books throughout the U.S. and Canada for sure. But online through at our site, fearlessflight.com, and as well as amazon.com.
That is fabulous. So for sure, we want people to get onto that website. And if you need to, you can look at my website at unlockingsecrets.com, go under resources and expert information, or you can go straight to www.fearless-flight.com to buy that book directly. Now, sort of in wrapping up, I would like you to just tell me about men. I found it quite interesting to find out that there was a man in our conversation, because I always associated the fear of flying with, you know, women and femininity, and they, you know, they're just afraid of everything, and the man comes in, he's the big brave guy, and, you know, he's not afraid of anything.
Right.
Sort of that stereotypical thought processes of males and females. What has surprised you about men, and do you find that men now are able to wrestle and expose sort of their fears a little bit more than what they used to in the past?
I do see an increase in that, you know, a greater acceptance in men of fallibility, you know, particularly when it comes to fear. I do believe that women remain the most courageous in terms of self-acknowledgement or self-admission, because what I see is about 2-to-1 women over men who come forward and acknowledge their fears. My personal belief is the numbers are about the same.
Mm.
It's just that women are more likely to do it. And there's another phenomenon I call counterphobia. So that, for example, pilots would be good candidates for counterphobics. That is to say that they have learned to repress their fears and detach from them so successfully, and maybe it's genetic, I don't know. But what happens is then they engage in riskier and riskier endeavors in life, so that, because to some degree, your level of anxiety sometimes gives you that feeling of aliveness. So
right.
Now I have to go out and ride motorcycles and jump out of airplanes or fly airplanes in order to tickle, if you will, that threshold of fear. But I think that when you look at male issues, men's issues, particularly in my own life, you find out that we're just really iron eggshells. You know, once you get through that hard exterior, there's just a lot of mush inside, and we're wired very much the same as women are. And we do have our fears, and they cause us to behave in interesting ways.
And there, then that's
the least.
And that's a whole nother show.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I joke sometimes, so the more you know who's flying up front, the less you want to fly back. But it's thank God that flying is the safest way to travel on the planet. What I wanted to do, Candace, was before we go, is to recommend to people that they checked out the website periodically, and I do have an e-learning DVD that I'm going to release this fall, hopefully. And in that, it's going to capture the essence of a fearful flyer course that people can do at their own pace. And we are redoing our website to include expanding the tele-seminar series, and also focus more on the coaching and other products that people can do at their leisure. Because after all, people, one of the control issues for most of us is we like to be in control of our own learning. So I'm gearing my services more in that direction.
Wow, that's fantastic. That is really, really good. We look forward to that. And of course, you know, the updates we'll be watching on our website, following through to your website, making sure that those updates are there and being able to encourage people. Well, Ron, I just want to thank you so much. And Captain Ron, as you're known in the Fearless Flight project, I just thank you for your time with me today. And I want to tell those that are listening that we would really like to invite Captain Ron to Vancouver, and we will be looking into how we can make those arrangements. So stay tuned on our website for information on that conference coming up. And I thank you for your time today. It's been great talking with you, and thank you for joining us on Unlocking Secrets for Women.
Thank you, Candace. It's been a pleasure.
I encourage you to purchase Captain Ron's book called Fearless Flight. It's made by the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, and it can be found in any bookstore, but you can also get it online at www.fearless-flight.com, or you can log onto my website, unlockingsecretsforwomen.com. It's actually unlockingsecrets.com, and look under resources and then expert information, and you'll see Captain Ron's Fearless Flight link right there, as well as my little story about my fear of flying. Thanks for joining me today on Unlocking Secrets for Women. For those of you who are interested in having a particular person interviewed by myself, feel free to contact me at candace@unlockingsecrets.com. Send me your request and I'll see what I can do. Thanks for joining me here on Unlocking Secrets for Women.